You know, it's actually so easy to forget where we actually are on a day-to-day basis. Like, think about your average morning routine.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
You walk down these perfectly poured, flawlessly leveled concrete sidewalks. You spend hours just, swiping and scrolling your thumb across this cold, impossibly smooth, illuminated glass screen.
Right, just completely surrounded by sterile infrastructure.
Exactly. We are completely, entirely surrounded by the frictionless infrastructure of modern life. And because our environment is so manicured, we're often just totally disconnected from the sheer staggering weight of the ancient history that's buried quite literally right beneath our feet.
It's like a cultural amnesia.
It really is.
Yeah.
I mean, do you ever stop and feel the weight of that forgotten history? Do you ever look at like a parking lot or a sidewalk and wonder what that exact patch of earth looked like or who stood on it centuries before the concrete was even poured?
Well, we've intentionally engineered our modern environment to be so impossibly smooth and, forward-facing that the past just starts to feel abstract.
Yeah, totally.
It feels like something that only exists in academic textbooks. Or maybe in museum glass cases, rather than something physically present in the soil we walk on every single day.
And that disconnect, that's the central challenge we're tackling in today's deep dive. Our mission today is to explore a truly fascinating paradox.
It is a massive paradox.
It is. How do you use the most futuristic, sterile, mass-produced tools of our modern age to actually capture the raw, ancient weight of indigenous history?
Because trying to translate blood, generational memory, and deep historical trauma through a media made entirely of, binary code and perfect light, it's a monumental artistic and philosophical challenge.
Which brings us to our sources for today. We have a really incredible stack of materials. We're diving into the technical notes, the artist manifesto, and the underlying creative philosophy behind a digital painting called Ancestros.
And that's part of a broader series called Trastio, Pintura Artistica, created by the artist Jero Duque.
Right. And the contrast at the very heart of this piece is just staggering when you look at the physical logistics of its creation. The paradox is totally wild.
Oh, the Whittier studio aspect.
Yes, consider the reality of this, the physical, or rather the digital act of creating this deeply historical piece happened on a plastic tablet. And he was sitting in a highly modern, everyday studio located in Whittier, California.
Just right in his daily trench, basically surrounded by the whole Los Angeles sprawl.
Exactly. But the art itself traveled both as data and as this massive concept to be exhibited as a physical manifestation in Palma, Spain in March 2024.
Which really sets up the core question for you listening today.
It does. How in the world do you paint the pain, the memory, and the immense dignity of an ancient people using mathematically perfect sterile pixels without it just looking like some cheap, flat internet cliche?
What's fascinating here is how the artist tackles the inherent bias of his own medium, because digital art, by its very nature, is programmed to fix things.
It wants everything to be clean.
Right. It wants to make edges clean. It wants to perfectly blend colors using these really complex automated algorithms. The software essentially has a built-in tendency to plasticize the subject matter.
Smooth out all the rough edges.
Exactly. And if an artist is trying to capture the soul and the grit of ancient history, well, that automated digital perfection is actually the biggest enemy in the room.
Okay, let's unpack this because the manifesto uses a really specific phrase to combat that exact problem, and I found it incredibly striking.
The active memory concept.
Yes, the artist calls this work an act of active memory. Now, normally, when we think of a historical painting, we think of a static image, right?
Like a frozen moment trapped in time.
Exactly. But he's striving for active memory. He wants this static, two-dimensional digital image to feel viscerally alive, like it is literally breathing on the canvas.
And to achieve that breathing quality, he has to wage this relentless technical rebellion against his own software.
Which is so cool to think about.
It is. The tools are undeniably modern,
Yeah.
The painting was built entirely in a program called Procreate, configured on a digital canvas scaled to 24 by 30 inches.
Right.
Yet the technique he employs is a deliberate, painstaking rejection of the sterile perfection those digital tools offer by default.
I was trying to figure out how to best visualize this tension for you listening, and it made me think of a very specific
Oh,
analogy.
I'd love to hear it.
So imagine a legendary music producer setting out to record a deeply soulful acoustic folk music album. We're talking about the kind of music that is deeply rooted in the earth, all wood and steel strings and raw vocals.
Okay, I'm with you.
but the producer is forced to record it using the most expensive, high-tech, futuristic digital synthesizers and soundboards in the world.
That would be a nightmare.
Right. If they let those machines do their job perfectly, filtering out every single flaw, the music would sound robotic and completely dead.
So what do they do?
They deliberately leave in the audio artifacts. They purposely keep the squeak of the musician's fingers sliding down the acoustic guitar strings.
Oh, I see.
They leave in the slight, you know, ragged intake of breath before the singer hits a difficult note. They use the high-tech gear, but they actively force it to preserve the soul, the friction, and the grit of the physical world.
That analogy actually translates perfectly to the visual realm here, because what the artist is doing in Procreate is essentially exactly that process of forced friction.
He's leaving the squeak on the strings.
He is literally sabotaging the digital software's foundational ability to create perfect brushstrokes.
Sabotaging it. I love that word for this.
Yeah, Procreate has all these built-in features like anti-aliasing and color blending math that calculate light and color values to create mathematically flawless, smooth gradients in microseconds.
It makes everything look beautifully airbrushed with basically zero effort.
Right, but the artist completely ignores them.
He just chooses to make the process infinitely harder on himself.
Well, he has to. If he lets the algorithm do the heavy lifting, he loses the humanity of the subject.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So instead of those smooth algorithms, he builds custom digital brushes that are intentionally designed to simulate physical resistance.
He wants the brush to drag.
Exactly. To drag, to catch, and to leave these jagged artifacts, just like a stiff bristle dragging across a rough physical canvas wood.
And he actively allows these harsh, clashing colors to just collide violently. Like, the notes detail him taking a very opaque, heavy green and crashing it directly into a yellow.
Completely refusing to blend them into a smooth, pleasing transition.
Right. And in the source material, he refers to this specific technique as preserving the stain and the breathing of the color.
Refusing to sacrifice that human touch is paramount. By forcing these pixel imperfections into the code, he creates what he calls a pictorial vibration.
A pictorial vibration.
Yeah. When a viewer looks at those harsh, unblended edges, the human eye registers the friction. It doesn't look smooth or calculated. It looks raw and human.
And that physical vibration on the screen translates directly into profound emotional depth for the viewer. Like, you can practically feel the human hand laboring behind the glass screen.
Absolutely.
So we see him sabotaging the mathematical perfection of the colors. And you can see that same intense discipline bleed directly into the subject matter itself.
The discipline of restraint.
Right, because if he's refusing to overblend his colors, it completely makes sense that he's also refusing to over-explain the history, which is how he avoids another massive pitfall outlined in the manifesto.
So you're talking about the trap of literalism.
Exactly.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of how indigenous history is traditionally depicted in Western art, there is this pervasive tendency to fall into what the artist's notes describe as folklorizing illustration.
And this is such a dangerous aesthetic trap.
It really is.
An artist approaches the subject wanting to be deeply respectful, right? But they end up treating the history like an anthropological catalog.
They get bogged down in the details.
Totally. They will obsess over painting the mathematically exact, historically accurate angle of a specific eagle feather, or they'll spend like 3 weeks rendering the flawless microscopic weave of a 1750s textile.
And obsessing over those literal ethnographic symbols actually strips the agency from the subjects.
How so?
Well, when an artist focuses entirely on the microscopic accuracy of a historical garment, they kind of reduce a living, complex culture to an exotic caricature designed for Western consumption.
It freezes them in time.
It freezes the subject. It turns a vibrant, breathing heritage into a static diorama in a natural history museum.
Wow, yeah. The people become mere aesthetic novelties.
Documentary artifacts rather than modern, breathing individuals with emotional lives. The artist here avoids this by strictly avoiding those literal symbols.
Which is so interesting because there are subtle visual markers in Ancestros, obviously. Like, you see the faint blue markings on the horse's face, you know, the subtle presence of feathers, the geometry of zigzag patterns.
But it's subtle.
Right. The restraint is incredible. He deliberately leaves out the massive, heavy-handed symbols you might expect to see in a piece about historical trauma.
There are no literal maps of dispossession painted in the background.
Exactly. There aren't countless overt symbols screaming at the viewer about lost native languages or specific broken treaties.
The historical weight is filtered through a lens of extreme poetic clarity.
It really is.
And this restraint extends to his color palette as well. Instead of using strident, highly saturated, loud colors that just scream for attention, he relies on subdued, serious, earthy tones.
That less is more approach, that respectful synthesis, it really prevents the art from feeling like a heavy-handed history textbook.
Or a political pamphlet trying to lecture you.
Right. By intentionally leaving things out, the image is allowed to breathe. It invites you, the listener, the viewer, to step into the frame and fill in the emotional gaps with your own empathy.
It demands your active participation, really, rather than just spoon-feeding you a history lesson.
And this overarching philosophy of stripping away the unnecessary, of forcing the viewer to focus entirely on the core emotion that actually dictates the very geometry of the painting itself.
Yes, the physical, spatial layout of Ancestros is highly intentional and breaks major historical conventions.
You're talking about the verticality of the digital canvas.
Exactly. I mean, think about traditional Western historical paintings, especially the ones dealing with the American West, the frontier, or vast territories.
They're almost always horizontal.
Always. They use wide, sweeping cinematic canvases, specifically designed to show off massive landscapes, huge expanses of sky, and endless tracts of land to be conquered.
But Ancestros utilizes an extremely tall, tight, vertical format. It radically changes how you experience the image.
Compressing the sides and stretching the canvas vertically eliminates the sweeping landscape entirely.
There's no horizon line to get lost in.
None. It forces the viewer's focus entirely, relentlessly, onto the relationship between the figures, specifically the deeply symbiotic relationship between the bareback riding indigenous woman and the horse she sits upon.
And the manifesto makes it very clear that in this specific cultural context, the horse is not a vehicle.
No, not at all.
It's not a machine designed to get a human from point A to point B the way modern infrastructure operates. The horse is described as a shared territory, an actual living extension of the human spirit.
And you can see that in the woman's posture, her bare feet resting against the animal, the relaxed drape of her leg, it depicts this profound, silent communion between two living beings.
And that tight vertical frame just locks your eyes onto that communion. You can't look away at the scenery because the scenery literally doesn't exist.
Exactly.
Now, I have to admit, I struggled with this specific aesthetic choice when I first read the notes. I want to push back on this a bit.
Go for it.
If you take these figures representing deep, ancient, geographically grounded roots, and you force them into a tight vertical crop, and then on top of that, you place them in a blurry, gray, completely undefined background.
Right, there's no landscape.
I mean, you look at this painting and you cannot pinpoint the geography. You can't type this background into Google Maps and say, oh, that's this specific valley in the Southwest. Doesn't that risk stripping these people of their actual physical roots?
That's a fair question.
By removing the landscape, don't they just become abstract, isolated ghosts floating in the middle of nowhere?
Well, it raises an important question, and it's a completely valid critique of vertical isolation in portraiture. Removing the geography can often remove the context.
Yeah, that was my worry.
However, the artist's philosophy provides a brilliant defense against this risk. His stated goal in the manifesto is to honor without freezing.
Honor without freezing. Oh, that echoes what we discussed about avoiding the museum diorama.
Precisely that. If he painted a highly specific, geographically accurate valley from 1850 in the background, he would be trapping these figures in amber.
They would just become historical fossils.
Belonging permanently and exclusively to the past. By rendering the background as undefined, swirling, and blurry, he isn't suggesting a lack of geography.
He's creating a mental space.
Yes. It's a psychological landscape where the deep past and our current present coexist simultaneously.
So they aren't floating in nowhere. They're floating in our collective memory.
And to address your concern about them looking like ghosts, look at the mechanical execution of the digital painting. Because of that heavy, sabotaged digital brushwork we discussed earlier, the figures possess incredible physical weight.
Oh, that's true. The strokes are really thick, opaque, and firm.
And the horse has one leg distinctly raised, indicating firm, heavy, deliberate movement forward. Ghosts do not possess that kind of gravity.
No, they don't.
These figures aren't fading away into the gray background. They are a constant, undeniable presence.
So, the artist is making a profound conceptual statement here. Their unconquered territory is no longer a specific, measurable valley on a map. Their unconquered territory is now memory itself.
Which completely shifts the perspective.
It does. They are marching forward out of the blurry past directly into our sharp present. And realizing that they're marching into our present forces us to look squarely at the incredibly harsh historical reality they're carrying with them.
It does.
Now, I want to pause here for you listening, because this next part of the source material touches on some incredibly raw, heavy history.
We need to be clear about our role here.
Yes. Yeah. Before we go further, I just want to explicitly state to you listening that we are impartially reporting the historical terms used in the artist's manifesto. We are not taking sides, debating, or endorsing the political viewpoints of the text. We are merely conveying the philosophical foundation of the original source material.
Right. Strictly through the artist's lens.
Exactly. So keeping that in mind, let's look at the foundation of this piece.
Well, it is deeply rooted in acknowledging historical trauma without flinching. The manifesto makes it explicitly clear that Ancestros is a direct, unapologetic homage to the native peoples of what is now the United States.
And the artist engages in this deliberate, highly intentional act of naming, right?
Yes. This isn't just a list. It is a conceptual form of resistance against historical oblivion.
Because he refuses to use a convenient blanket term. The notes are incredibly specific, explicitly listing the Navajo or Diné, the Apache, the Lakota, the Cherokee, the Choctaw, the Creek or Muscogee, the Iroquois or Haudenosaunee, the Sioux.
And he makes a very pointed note to reference that there are over 570 more distinct sovereign nations.
Refusing to let those distinct identities be blurred into a single, easily digestible monolith is such a crucial part of the act of memory.
And the language he uses in his notes to describe the history of these nations is intentionally blunt.
Very blunt.
He completely rejects soft, sanitized language. The sources state he frames the historical process using terms like extermination, systematic expulsion, and brutal dispossession.
He even goes as far as framing the historical reservation system as a form of concentration camps utilized during the violent building of the modern state.
Those are incredibly heavy, aggressive, dark historical realities.
They really are. But here's where it gets really interesting. When you read those brutal words in the manifesto, you naturally expect the actual painting to reflect that chaos.
Right. You expect a battle scene.
Exactly. You expect to look at the digital canvas and see romanticized violence, clashing armies, fire, absolute destruction.
A sprawling historical epic of tragedy.
Yes. But you don't see a single drop of that chaos.
You see the exact opposite.
The artist actively chooses to depict serene dignity over a violent historical epic. The indigenous woman on the horse is calm. Her posture is upright and relaxed. Her gaze is steady and unwavering.
It is a portrait of profound peace.
But why? Why choose that profound serenity when the history you are directly referencing is so undeniably dark?
Because dignity is ultimately far more powerful and honestly far more disruptive than an epic narrative.
Disruptive is a great word for it.
If we connect this to the bigger picture of how history is usually told in Western culture, an epic requires conflict. An epic requires a neat narrative of winners and losers.
It requires noise, violence, and a definitive end.
Exactly. By refusing to paint a violent epic, the artist refuses to accept that Western framework of finality. Dignity, on the other hand, is completely silent. It is enduring.
It doesn't need to shout to prove it still exists.
By painting serene dignity amidst a history of dispossession, the artist is making a radical declaration. He is stating that the history of these people did not begin with Western conquest, and it certainly does not end with modern infrastructure.
It's an unbroken, ongoing continuum.
The piece frames the earth not as a piece of real estate to be fought over, violently looted, or legally deeded, but as a vast, ancient network of mutual respect.
The dignified, calm posture of the writer just says, "We were here, we are here, and our way of understanding the earth remains entirely valid and unbroken."
That's the power of the piece.
So what does this all mean for you listening right now? We started this deep dive talking about the sterile concrete sidewalks and the frictionless glass screens that dominate our daily lives.
Our era of absolute doom scrolling.
Yeah, exactly. We're constantly bombarded with this overwhelming flood of digital information, most of it fleeting, shallow, and explicitly designed by algorithms to make us anxious and disconnected from our physical reality.
But in a world like that, art pieces like Ancestros act as vital anchors. They force the scroll to stop.
They really do. They prove that this modern technology, the exact same glowing screens and mathematical pixels that often distract us into oblivion, can actually be subverted.
They can be sabotaged.
Yes. Sabotaged in the most beautiful way possible to keep ancient memory fiercely alive. The work bridges this massive gap between a plastic tablet in a modern California studio and the deep ancestral roots of the human experience.
Which brings us to a final thought, something to really chew on as we wrap up this deep dive. It builds right on this idea of the painting's mental space.
What's the thought?
Well, for everyone listening tomorrow, when you step out of your front door, what if you stop seeing the modern concrete street merely as infrastructure to get you from point A to point B?
Oh, wow.
What if you actively chose to perceive the ground you walk on as a living memory, a shared eternal territory with the cultures and ancestors who walked it centuries before you? How would that change the way you step into the world?
That is such a powerful question to leave on. The idea of literally shifting how we perceive the ground under our feet tomorrow morning. Keep that in mind next time you walk out the door. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Ancestros. Take care, and we'll catch you next time.